All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his act being seven ages. At first the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like a snail unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like a furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths, and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly, with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side. His youthful hose well saved a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice, turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange history, is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. From As You Like It, William Shakespeare. How fortunate are you and I, whose home is timelessness, we who have wandered down from fragrant mountains of eternal now, to frolic in such mysteries as birth and death, a day, or maybe even less. E. E. Cummings. So it is with Christ. He did not confer upon himself the glory of becoming high priest. It is granted by God, who said to him, "Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee," as also in another place he says, "Thou art a priest forever in the succession of Melchizedek." In the days of his earthly life, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud tears and cries to God, who was able to deliver him from the grave. Because of his humble submission, his prayer was heard. Son though he was, he learned obedience in the school of suffering, and once perfected, became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, named by God high priest in the succession of Melchizedek. That's from Hebrews 5. And flowing out of that is an exhortation to those who follow Christ. You need endurance if you are to do God's will and win what he has promised. For soon, very soon, in the words of Scripture, he who is to come will come. He will not delay. And by faith, my righteous servant shall find life. But if a man shrinks back, I take no pleasure in him. But we are not among those who shrink back and are lost. We have the faith to make life our own. That's these readings are a kind of preface, perhaps more than that, they are the substance of the details that we will be discussing during this time. The theme of this time is Christian faith and human development. I'm using as chief resource the thoughts, the descriptions, rather, of what the human story is that Erik Erikson has come up with. Erikson was the first child psychoanalyst in this country, coming to this country in the 1930s as part of the set of refugees who came from Europe because of the troubles that were beginning to happen then. He has taught in lots of places in this country, on the East Coast and the West Coast, from Harvard to San Francisco to Pittsburgh. He has lived on a couple of Indian reservations. He has been a therapist for rich kids and for poor kids. And he's been to India quite a lot to study and write about Gandhi. He's written a book about Gandhi called Gandhi's Truth that the people in, I've heard Indian scholars say, is one of the best books about India that they have seen, and about Gandhi. And that's high praise because it's somebody who is not part of the culture. In 1958, 20 years ago, wrote a book on Martin Luther, called Young Man Luther. Lutheran historians ever since have been saying he's wrong, but people keep fussing, and 20 years later they're still writing books about Erikson writing that book. So something must be going on. He is somebody who is quoted in social science and psychological circles very much. When he comes out of the new book, people go out and see what it's about. Today, I want to sort of work with you a little bit on the heart of that, of much of what he thinks about, and that's his version of the life cycle, and talk about how this may illuminate the story of faith, the development of faith, the nature of us as religious beings. And maybe there are some implications for us as parents, as church members, members of society, as well as for our own individual growth and amazement. When I arrived here a few days ago, I put this in the bulletin board, and it must have so much intrinsic authority, it just stays in the blackboard. Here it is. These are the eight stages. Trust versus mistrust, or basic trust versus mistrust. Building upon that, autonomy versus shame, doubt, initiative versus guilt, industry versus inferiority, identity versus diffusion, intimacy versus isolation, generativity versus stagnation, integrity versus despair. This is the first year of life, approximately the second and third year of life, approximately the third, fourth, fifth or so of years of life, strictly looked at. Industry versus inferiority, the primary school years, identity versus diffusion, adolescence, intimacy versus adolescence, intimacy versus isolation, so the end of adolescence, moving into early adulthood, generativity versus stagnation, the stage or the crisis of the center of productive adulthood, covering many years, integrity versus despair, dealing with becoming old and being old and facing death. This is not a ladder that one climbs. It is not a series of success steps whereby you help yourself to the fruits of psychological happiness. It's Erickson's analysis of the human condition. The basic word in it all is the versus. These are conflicts within us as persons. They are conflicts within the culture that within which we live as well. He sees this diagram fitting not just for, it's not the story of individualism. It's a story of how we fit in culture. And maybe as we get along in this discussion, we'll see some of that. Every person, all his life, is dealing with these eight crises. It's just that as we move through life, the trust versus mistrust crisis seems to be the one that focuses all the other crises of being human as a child, as a baby. When you get to the adolescent, all these other of the adolescent years, all these other things are very much involved. But the crisis that focuses the teenage years tends to be the identity versus diffusion, identity diffusion crisis. When you're in the business of being a parent and manager of a household and worker and a teacher or whatever that you do to take care of the world, this crisis is the one, generativity versus stagnation, that holds sort of all these together. And finally, the last crisis is to look at all the bits and pieces that you have come up with in the in your living out your 60 years or 70 or so years, and
seeing it as a whole. But that isn't the first time you struggled with integrity versus despair. You did it the first big depression you had when you were 5 years old. You were dealing with the confusions and disappointments of life and why things don't add up. And you had your version of dealing with it when you were five. Erickson says that in his study of Martin Luther, that as a young adult, that Luther put these last four crises all in one big package. And his struggle for a gracious God, his search for a gracious God, he was dealing with his identity crisis, his intimacy crisis, his generativity crisis, his integrity crisis. That's why it was such a massive crisis for Luther, because there's so much involved. He also says about all twice born, struggling kinds of religious people who have things like conversions or tough or inner readjustments in their relationship to God, they are usually combining a whole lot of these crises in resolving their religious faith crises. And Erickson also says something about, in his Young Man Luther book, where he said that he sees that the reason for Luther's power at his time and in the years since, he continues to be a charismatic figure, an inspiring figure, a meaningful figure for lots of people as they work out their own relationships with themselves and God. That Luther took into himself the crises, the cultural crises of his time, the religious crises of his time, worked it out in his own sort of personal battles, and his answer that came back spoke then to lots of people almost immediately. So the Luther's gospel had power because it is wrenched out of the depths of one man's battle of one man's search for a gracious God. And all of these crises involved for Luther were also involved for lots of people in his time. The integrity that Luther was able to manage helped, therefore, lots of people to have a handle on integrity for themselves. All right. I just want to describe each of these stages and maybe make some suggestions about how they tie into some things that are theological. Trust versus mistrust. The struggle, the crisis of infancy. Erickson summarizes a whole lot of research when he describes this time. The task of this time is to find that you have a right to be here. To have it way down in your bones, so to speak. It's clear from the research that the child can get the point pretty fast that somehow or other it's not all right for him to be or her to be. By the fact that he or she is isolated, not talked to,
not prized in ways, not played with, not talked to. Research from things like, from awful things like René Spitz's study in the Foundling Home in England during the Second World War shows that children early in life can have all their physical needs taken care of for food, warmth, protection, and so on. But if they don't have this just time with another, with a human being who plays with them, talks to them, somehow or other enjoys that child's existence, the child gets the point that it's not okay. He's not okay, she's not okay. And Erickson says that this leads to a kind of basic mistrust about oneself, a basic sadness, a basic hopelessness. Sometimes you have a chance to observe it in people who maybe came from a broken home at this time, where the child was passed from one person to another, never were sure what was going on, and the child can pick up this uncertainty and all kinds of fears and anxieties through its skin very quickly. And then after maybe things finally get straightened out in the child's life after a year or so, and the child may get the best sort of mothering thereafter, or parenting thereafter. But there remains a kind of basic sadness, a sense of never quite getting enough. The child, that person can, 40 years later, can have all kinds of affirmation right and left, and somehow or other it can't quite sink in. Because the time for the basic message, the basic response from the world to the child, didn't get said at the most important time. Erickson, in his study of Luther, suggests that maybe there was maybe Luther had a whole lot of this basic trust resources early in his life, but maybe there were some places where it wasn't quite enough, and he could never quite accept himself as being worthwhile and justified, received before the in the eyes of God. And only the discovery of justification by grace through faith finally got through to Luther how dearly he was received in this world by God. And that discovery freed him up to go through all the other stages, as it were, very quickly again, and have increased autonomy, initiative, industry, and so on. And the among the many remarkable things about Martin Luther that Erickson picks up, as well as other people have picked up, is that the immense capacity for this man to produce and create and free up lots of areas of life for himself and for other people, that indicates a very basic grounding in a very basic foundation, a basic sense of trustworthiness in the world. Erickson points out the basic phenomenon, the basic dialogue, the basic image of the first year of life. He says it's the child held at the breast. Whether the child is actually fed, breastfed or not, probably doesn't make that much difference. But when you feed a child, how do you hold the child? Like this, the bottle or something here. And so as the child is being nourished physically and taking care of that ache and pain down below, that caused him or her to cry. The child is in dialogue, eye to eye, with a caretaker, a caregiver. And this dialogue is a primary built into the culture. First of all, it isn't, you know, it's far more than an individual thing that the child has to create. All of these things are all these stages have to do with patterns of interacting between the individual and others. Here, the culture is in the business of giving, and including the giving of an eye, of a presence to another. And it's as that is being given to the child learns to receive. Erickson goes into this in pretty broad ways, but I just want to confine myself to this one thing. His basic message is, we don't automatically know how to be with another human being. Learning relationship is something we learn to do. And it's built into the patterns of interaction that our culture has built around our growing up, around our developing as human beings. So, the child literally learns to receive love as he or she is loved. He learns to be loved. And you probably know some people who you get very frustrated with because as much as you try to love them, they can't let themselves be loved. And Erickson is sort of suggesting that maybe this is a building block of a process that they never got developed with, so to speak, with people in the world. Two more things, and there's a hand in the back, and I'll pick it up. Religiously, Erickson points to the power of the Madonna image in Roman Catholic piety. And the image there is of seeing the mothering face to face, and the assurance that there is for that, and how in traditional piety, Catholic piety, at least the notion is, well, if God and Christ seem quite a bit daunting to you in your prayers, try the Virgin Mary. The face of the mother, the primary face, the first one to reassure you that everything is okay, no matter how lousy your stomach and other pains and your teeth may be, problems may be giving you. In our Protestant, well, in all Christian services and also Jewish services, because it comes from the Old Testament, there's the passage from Numbers, the benediction. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift his countenance upon you and give you peace. Not once, but twice, the reassurance is of a face, going back to the primary face-to-face reassurance. Erickson has some reflections. There are lots of things where I'll be making up my own as we work on this. But in baptism, he himself has some reflections on baptism, and Luther's strong position for infant baptism, in spite of the struggles with all the problems about infant baptism. Does a child really know what's going on here, and so on, and does, can you speak of the child having faith and all that, and so on. Erickson says that if we can see the child as right from the beginning, being able to receive a warm relationship, a caring relationship, that the child from the beginning can know that it is cherished or not. That fits in with the message of baptism as Lutherans have traditionally talked about it, that baptism is about God's initiative, not our decision for baptism, but God. Baptism is, first of all, God's gift to us, God's gift of a relationship, God's gift of taking us on as his children right from the beginning, not on the basis of what we can offer, but on the basis of his cherishing us as his own, making a covenant with us right from the beginning that we can count on forever. And Luther was fond of going back and saying, when all else is gone, when I can't see my way clear to any way, I can't understand what God is doing with me and in the world at all, everything is dark, I go and go back to my baptism and say, I was baptized. I can always hang on to that. That kind of radical trust, where I don't feel anything good, I can't figure out anything good, I can't make any moves toward of being strong at all, I can look to my baptism and say, that's an indication way down deep that I can trust no matter how dark the things are. And Erickson says this sort of the same thing, that once you have developed this layer, this dimension of basic trust in your life, lots of things can be taken away from you. Your hopes right and left can get dashed, but you continue to hope against hope. When you can hope when there doesn't seem to be any sense to it, and on that basis build yourself, build life again, grow again from that foundation. In a way, I've spent more time in this one because there's, in many ways, there's a lot more to it. But it's the one, and I also spend more time with it because Erickson says that religion, as functioning in this way, as a source for basic trust, is the fundamental social institution that he builds into his scheme of human development. Each of the stages has a fundamental social cultural institution. For trust versus mistrust, it's religion. And Erickson says, if institutional religion is not able to provide people with functioning resources for basic trust, they're going to go look for it someplace else. And if religion does not gear itself in some way or other to really reach down to where people are, so that parents and children can be supported in their process of being with each other out of that religion, that their religion is a whole lot of worthless junk. It's not working at all. It's worthless. So just to go on with this institution stuff bit, the autonomy, the next stage, autonomy versus shame and doubt, ties in with the law and order, with the whole all sets of institutions having to do with law, with patterns of obedience that are necessary for society. The next stage has to do with society's capacity to have heroes. The next stage after that ties in with the patterns of making a living, of technology, and all these. At this point, I'm going to stop and see if there are any questions with this before I launch on and try to say something about some more of the stages. Any comments or questions? Yes?
Would Erickson say that if a child does not received the love and care at the important stage in his infancy, that child could never truly feel loved, could never be taught to feel loved as he grows up. I'm thinking of a friend of mine who adopted a child at an older age and apparently had a real rough first few years, and now as a teenager simply cannot receive love no matter how hard they've tried, and would Erickson say that would be a normal kind of a thing? Is there a possibility of teaching that love through the church or through parenting?
He thinks there is. Contrary to some people who are more in the Freudian camp, who say everything is sort of fixed when you're five, Erickson has a lot of that same psychoanalytic bias. It's going to be tough. But the message of one of the messages of young man Luther, as I said, is that there can be a turnabout, a kind of conversion, psychologically and religiously, that people finally can catch on. Though there are many things about the some of the things in the neo-Pentecostal stuff in our time, one of the things that they have been able to do, it seems, is do quite a bit for people who struggle in drugs, have been able to by their caring, very powerfully caring community, get across to people how absolutely loved they are, and that this is from the very essence of all there is. It is they're able to convey to people who are in very tough circumstances that they are loved. Sometimes it may take a powerful, well done personal growth groups, therapy groups. Sometimes it takes one-to-one counseling for a long time. Sometimes it's you hear stories about, say, men who've had gone through the school of hard knocks right from the beginning, and somehow ended up with a very loving mate who was finally able, with years of struggle, to get across to this guy that basically, fundamentally, he is cherished. He is that it's good for him to be. But it's a tough struggle, and sometimes you're ready to give up and say this person is never ever going to get the point. And sometimes they don't, because it's a very crucial thing to have happen. I think of so many things I don't want to add to this stage, but I better not. Other comments or questions? Yeah.
The thing while you were talking about Erickson there, the thing that I saw is that once you come up with a theory, not to say whether it's right, wrong, or if you're not, once you come up with a theory, the tendency is to then look at the results. You know, you say, well, you know, this is the theory I have. Then you look at the results to validate the theory. So the trust-mistrust theory, you know, you look at what happens in life and you say, well, you know, that validates the fact that if you experience trust right off the bat, your life works. And if somebody has actually got all the form of having been trusted and their life doesn't work, then you come back and say, well, it must have been something else on top of that. All I'm saying is I don't want to invalidate the theory, but you need to continue to look and see if it works, you know, if it fits in your own life,
yeah.
Rather than buying someone else's theory for explanation of your life. And I think that's the value that you're really talking about,
yeah.
is getting across that. But here's a way to look at it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, there's no satisfaction or happiness or anything in being able to explain something. You know, it's the experience of your of your relationships, of your life actually working that, you know, that happiness is a byproduct of.
Now, Erickson himself, and certainly I do not say that the way to happiness is to learn these eight stages, memorize these eight stages, and then go to try to figure out, manipulate your life and your children's life into having something like this. Rather, he's trying to describe, by looking at lots of different kinds of people, lots of different life cycles, he's trying to describe some common themes, and he's trying to do this cross-culturally, that seem to be there wherever you go. And they are senses, he calls them, first of all, he says, you don't know this rationally, you kind of operate in terms of a deep down sense of being trusting or being mistrusting or whatever. You don't go walk around, if you have a good capacity for basic trust, you don't go walk around saying, I'm trusting. You go around living that way. Or if an adolescent finally comes to the identity crisis and comes to some sort of wholeness of putting the whole his or her story together, he doesn't go walk around saying, hey, I put my identity together. He or she just lives more wholly, more strongly, moves on to the next stage, in fact, of wanting to invest that identity in intimacy with another. So there's a kind of rhythm whereby, or a throbbing sort of, where when you, and you can observe this in little children, say, who've had a pretty good set of resources for the first year of life. They move on to the next stage of autonomy versus shame or doubt. They sort of built up a kind of a battery of resources, and now they want to try it out. A kid who's got some capacity to trust is the one who's more likely to get in trouble because he's more vigorously entering the autonomy time. The ones who wonder whether it's all right for them to be in the world will kind of huddle up and kind of be quiet and hope nobody runs into them and does anything bad to them. Whereas the ones who feel okay about themselves and being in the world charge into the next stage and are likely to be more trouble to deal with, and so on down the line. They have energy to invest, and the basic message of this whole stuff is you get it not to sort of hoard it, but to use it then by getting more and more involved with life. And the radius of significant relationships for Erickson goes wider and wider and wider, so that in the integrity time you are not sitting there, so to speak, having your sense of well-being tied to your individual story, your individual skin, as it were, but you get your sense of wholeness from having a sense of being tied in with being a brother and sister of all of existence, all of the human story, and that held together in your unique way of being in the world, being both terribly unique and terribly universal at the same time. That's how you move on out through these stages, as Erickson sees the metabolism thereof. Yeah.
Yeah, and a stop to that would be to look at, you know, autonomy versus shame or doubt, or trust versus mistrust, as trust is better than mistrust, and you try to make your child be trustworthy, in which case you start to feel guilty if you don't do that,
yeah.
In which case he picks up guilt and shame. I mean, it's a trap to make one better than the other. But the truth is, if you just let it be and act your own life out of your own sense of integrity, that the child will develop in the natural process.
Yeah.
And that each one of those things present as a crisis of, you know, I've got to handle it right now. I've got to get to autonomy, which would be a stop to the kind of life that you're talking about. If you look at a crisis as an opportunity to discover more about yourself, life becomes a journey or a discovery or a, you know, Christopher Columbus trip, which is very, very exciting.
The parent is on his or her journey. The child is on his or her journey. And the two crises, the two stages intermesh. Mm-hmm. The parent is trying to figure out what, at all sorts of levels, what it is to be a parent. And the child is his teacher, or her teacher, and vice versa. Erickson's point is that the best gift you offer to the succeeding generation is your own strength, your own dignity, your own capacity to trust. If you can trust as a parent, living in the world as it is, if you today, looking out at the world, can say, I'm still going to have kids, and mean it, you have the basic resource for dealing with the kids that you do have. For each one, it's an adventure in an uncertain world. For the parent and for the child. And if our culture, if our faith provides us with the basic virtue, basic strength, we are able to provide each other strength. It's a very community kind of picture that Erickson has here. It is not a self-help kind of thing to fit with the last hour's discussion. It is a description of the dynamics of our being together as human beings. Yeah.
Is it possible, though, that a child is taught to mistrust when given conditional love by the parent? The parent speaks to their own mistrust and says, if you're not pleasing to me, I will not love you. And you create a lack of trust in the child, even. They might have started out okay, but they just hit them with this.
There's the point is, what kind of trust are you teaching? Is it a conditional kind of thing with lots of ifs in it, or does it sort of receive the child and then build from there? And also the point about that you need both sides of it. That's an important kind of thing. That's a part of combating turning this into another success ideology. We need to mistrust as well. There are certain things in life where it's healthy to learn to mistrust. The Erickson's, and it's saying there's a certain place for us to have some shame, a certain place to have some doubt, there's a certain place to have some guilt, there's a certain sense even to have a little bit of inferiority. Great actors, actresses, always go on the stage, even though they've done the performance 1,000 times, still battling the possibility that they might be inferior. So they get in there, deal with the stage fright one more time, get themselves revved up, and get out there and struggle with that one again. So that it's the dynamic of living in the tension. Erickson says what he hopes for all of us is that we have a favorable ratio of trust over mistrust. So the child has learned to trust that most people are okay, but some aren't, and you better check them out. Else you're going to be a sucker for every guy who comes along with, you know, give me your $50 and I'll make you rich kind of thing. And there are some people who have probably been taught by something or other to be suckers, to trust too much. You can get Erickson's point about autonomy. The next stage is that they're realistically, we are not autonomous. There is, but nevertheless, it's something to be developed inside. He says the basic achievement of the autonomy stage, growing out of the foundation of the trust crisis, is that we have a sense of having willed lots of things that have to be. I was born on the plains of North Dakota of German parents, etc., etc., etc. I didn't have the autonomy. I never had the autonomy to break away from that. But somehow or other, I had to will some of the things that came with that and take it on as my own. The child has to move through this no stage, the terrible twos, where everything you say is answered by no, where the child is discovering it has a will. It's got to have that battle instead of being crushed and saying, you spoiled brat, you're never going to say no to me again. The parent has enough strength to let the child have some rope, but also enough strength to put boundaries, to put limits, to let the child try out some of these things, and little by little discover that it can have a will, it can say no, it finally can learn to say yes, if you are patient enough with it and sly enough with it. Not manipulating either, I don't think. But out of your own integrity as a person, as a parent, you are able to foster the same kind of integrity in the child, and the child then can learn to cooperate, can have the outcome is not that the child gets everything it ever wants in absolute individualistic autonomy, but learns to be with people in a cooperative kind of way. Learns to have a sense that it can want something, and that's okay, but also learn to respect what other people want, and together work things out in the spirit of cooperation. And this is not something that you will into being with one spanking or one lecture when the child is 2 and a half, but it's by living with the child, by putting up with some things, and letting the child put up with some of your stuff at the same time, and together the child comes out of it with some capacity to be cooperative, and so on down the line. And as the child has learned that sense of being, having worked through the sense of being a separate being, Erickson says the second stage is working through a sense of being separate, and not let that become a terrifying thing. When you're too much separate, then you're ashamed. And so we blush to cover ourselves up with this red color, so people won't really see us. He speaks about this very phenomenologically, and there's lots of interesting kind of turns that you can make with this. Doubt comes out of the sense that you stand up. And when you stand up and you're 2 and a half, you live in a world of giants, and you wonder, should I have stood up at all? It doesn't seem to make any point. Can I actually stand up? Can I ever stand on my 2 feet? And if big people use their power too much on this child who's learning to stand up for the first time, or lets that little kid be the tyrant of the house and unrealistically order all these big people around, that's an unfavorable outcome also. You have to figure out some way of working out the bigness and smallness. And if it's done pretty well, then the child is ready to take on Big Daddy Corporation in a right sort of way later on, rather than in absolute organization subservience on the one hand, or unremitting rebellion on the other that keeps getting him and everything into a mess. One of my reflections on the 60s, and it ties in with other people's analysis of the late 60s and early 70s, the rebellion, it seemed to me there are a lot of young people who had been early in life taught that they could have absolute autonomy. Just anything you want, kid, we have the resources, let's, okay. And we believe in freedom, and so on and so on. And then came the time for running up into some of the realities of the world, and came some of the strange sort of rebellion. There was lots of legitimate reasons for some of the rebellion, but some of the sick kind of stuff seemed to come out of the business of not really having to battle through the autonomy stage at the proper time, so they had to do it 15 years later or so. In relationship to faith, the Bible and theologians reflecting in the Bible point out how much of the Bible, how much of faith has to do with obedience. And Luther says that if you want to talk about the basic word about what faith is, it is to put is thou shalt have no other gods before me. It is an obedience statement, an obedience to God as God, to work out my freedom, so to speak, in worship, not in any other way, not with any other form whereby I'm going to, not any other form of obedience. So the second fundamental dimension of faith, as seems to me from the scriptures, is obedience, building on trust, which is also a very powerful thing that scripture talks about as being a part of faith. Well, this always happens. I only get a little ways into this, mm-hmm. and we missed a lot of more stuff on initiative and so on, and some of the other stages that we're more aware of, the adult stages. So far, we tend to do some speculating about what kids are like and so on. At least I think I've demonstrated the developmental process that we are in, that it's a crisis kind of thing, that it's sort of at the center of what being human is. It's part of that this developmental stuff is at the center of being human. It's at the center of the human adventure, and that we can look at faith as a developmental process also. We saw it in the life of Jesus, as I read from Hebrews, and it's also the kind of thing that we can use as a helpful model to look at our movement through life. I think maybe when I come back here on Wednesday, where I speak about faith as living of a story, that maybe I'll be able to pick up some of the themes that I would do as a filling out of what I started here this morning. So I better quit because it is about time. If somebody want to stay around and chat a little bit for a few more minutes, we can do that.